Okay, what has the greatest tropical forest, the longest mountain range, the longest and most voluminous river, and wildest wilderness? Of course, it's the Amazon. Founder of the Amazon Conservation Team, ethnobotanist Mark Plotkin has followed the lead of scientists and explorers before him. With a hands-on Amazon education, Mark is a great world citizen, pulling his weight and then some. His latest book is The Amazon, What Everyone Needs to Know. I'm Robin with Tributaries. So, Mark, you're introducing us to the potentially beautiful and new world of vampire bat saliva, frog slime, and cross-dressing spiders. So thank you, I think.
Happy to do so, Robin. I mean, much of conservation is focused on very attractive mammals, typically large mammals, whales, elephants, and pandas, and there's nothing wrong with that. But as an ethnobotanist, I've always been more interested and more intrigued by the potential medical applications of nature, and they tend to be things that are kind of creepy in quality, not just plants, but snakes, bats, spiders, and other poisonous critters that most of us prefer to avoid.
There is so much I'd like to share from your new Oxford Press book, The Amazon, What Everyone Needs to Know. And still, I want to take just a moment to tell you how much I love the initial quote you use from Alexander von Humboldt's assistant, saying he will go mad if the wonders do not cease. It just paints such an amazing picture. And is there still that for you in your travels to the Amazon?
Absolutely. And that's true of every naturalist, every biologist, even every first-timer, that every time you think you kind of got a grip or kind of handle on what's going on, there's some new, incredible, amazing thing that happens. I'll give you one quick example. We've just figured out that there's three species of electric eels in the Amazon. Now, electric eels have been studied since 1756. I mean, that's, what, 250 years by Linnaeus, and we're still finding new species. And these aren't little mites that live in a parrot's nostrils. You know, these are big honking 8-foot slabs of meat. And so one of the other things they found was that these eels hunt in packs, because the scientific literature says they hunt individually, which is all I've ever seen. And I called a colleague of mine in Suriname, and he called a shaman in the far south, in the middle of the forest, because they all have cell phones now, and said, do electric eels hunt individually or in packs? And he says, both. Everybody knows that. So we're still learning.
Oh, my gosh. I'm sure every day there's new information. Well, let's not jump right now into the political, but your knowledge, Mark, and your book are amazingly in-depth and thorough. And can you share something of the actual physical Amazon area? Are the Amazon rainforest and the Amazon basin considered the two main areas? And maybe you could describe them a little bit.
Well, we think of the Amazon as Brazil, at least most people do. But the Amazon reaches its leafy tendrils into nine different countries. So Brazil is about 63% of the Amazon forest. It's definitely not the whole thing. What a lot of people don't realize, in addition to this, is that diversity increases with altitude, meaning that Colombia and Peru, which are obviously much smaller than Brazil, have an enormous amount of biodiversity. So the battle to save the Amazon is not going to be won or lost solely in Brazil. And, you know, if you read the early accounts, and I went back to a lot of them in writing my new book for Oxford Press, you cannot help be struck by how these people compare the forest to a cathedral. And I think, in a way, it's kind of backwards, because I think many of the great cathedrals, like we see in Europe, were actually designed based on that feeling of awe and nature people got by walking in any great forest. That the canopy high overhead, the giant pillars around you, it's just as we know in the tropics, these things are brimming for diversity in ways that a European or American forest never did.
Right, and the Amazon is really the home of diversity, and the forest floor and canopy, which I loved, was also called a green ocean. There's such contrast, and yet there they are in the same place. So can you share about the canopy and that area in the forest floor and maybe some things about them?
Well, the canopy as you said, has been described as the Green Ocean. This was done by William Beebe, a fantastic naturalist from the early 20th century who worked for the Bronx Zoo. And as botanists, you're always kind of penalized because you just can't truck through it. It's, you know, 100 feet off the forest floor, and it's not only full of species of plants and animals, it's full of stinging insects and poisonous snakes. So it's not something you'd want to, like, hang out in if you didn't have to. But as a botanist, you're always looking for places where the forest is being felled, either, you know, a giant tree keeled over, or there's some forestry operations, so you can have a sense of what's up there. And I just worked with a colleague named Bruce Hoffman, who spent 15 years writing the first book on the lianas, that is the woody vines of the Amazon, you know, what Tarzan swung through in Africa, because that's the least known group of plants. But in the Northeast Amazon, where I've done much of my work, 30% of the medicines are based on these lianas, which botanists could never identify because they climbed up and flowered in the canopy. So that yet it's another world we're still discovering. At the same time, it's another world we're destroying.
Yes, and what is he finding with these vines? I don't know much about them, but I just really find them infinitely fascinating because they're so woody, and the way they do climb, and are they heading for the sun? Do they need a lot of sun? Or?
Well, they're outsmarting the trees, Robin, because what they're doing is hanging on the trees and reaching the sun, which means they have to put a lot of energy into creating support systems like trees do. So the whole thing is a fight for sunlight so they can photosynthesize, and the lianas are taking advantage of the trees by climbing onto them and, in some cases, above them. Now, there's two particularly interesting angles to this liana woody vine story. One is that ayahuasca, the increasingly famous vine of the Amazon, is a liana, that Johns Hopkins, a very prestigious university right near here in Baltimore, just established a center for hallucinogenic plant research.
Yes.
Because what we're finding is that these shamanic plants and fungi are the key to treating and sometimes curing supposedly incurable diseases like PTSD or depression or end-of-life fears in terminal cancer patients. So that makes tropical lianas more interesting all over again. The other thing that we're noting about them, which is more frightening, is that they're increasing in size, which seems to indicate a reaction to climate change. So we don't know what this is going to mean for forest structure and diversity. It's just one of the things that scientists are noting and not able to draw a conclusion about at this point in time.
I would really hang on that we don't really know the reason. I don't know. I just feel like so much is blamed or caused by the climate change. Let's hold that in such a huge circle of influence and as influencer, I would say, but not get too dogmatic or stuck in it. And as you mentioned with the ayahuasca, for instance, and that might be the most obvious one, but medicinal plant discovery is steeped in the entire history of humans living in the Amazon. I'm sure a lot by trial and error, but to me it seems it totally borders on the cosmic otherworldly knowing. And I'm wondering what your experience is or what you've learned in conversation about this with shaman.
Well, you know, I did a chapter on ayahuasca for this new book, and one of the most intriguing aspects of ayahuasca, and this is known to anybody who's ever taken it or studied it, is that ayahuasca is actually a combination of two plants, and sometimes many more. There's the ayahuasca plant itself, which botanists know as Banisteriopsis caapi, and then there's another plant that's mixed in, Justicia pectoralis, which is a completely different plant, doesn't look anything like it, completely different family, and when they mix together, the results are truly cosmic. In other words, they have complex chemicals in each that affect the other and make it way, way more potent. So my question to you or anybody or the cosmos is how the hell did these medicine women or medicine men figure out what two plants in a forest of 40,000 plants to combine to make this happen?
Exactly.
And it truly and literally boggles the mind.
Absolutely. Well, what do the shaman that you've worked with, do they have this question or do they just like not even go there. That's one rabbit hole we could all go down, of course. But once you have this, then there are perhaps more interesting or time better spent going down another rabbit hole.
Well, as a scientist, I'm not supposed to say this, because when ISM, they say, well, we take the brew and it tells us, the plants talk to us.
Right.
So from a scientific perspective, it doesn't make any sense. But I've not heard a better explanation. So, you know, it was Carl Jung who said, I don't engage in the fashionable practice of dismissing something just because I can't understand it. So I'll cite him in this instance.
Right. That should be written on the graduation keychain of every ethnobotanist, right?
Oh, well, I think it's inscribed on their heart, but I think it should be inscribed on the forehead, figuratively at least, of everybody on the planet.
Mm, yes, no doubt. Thank you for that. Considering the soil is very acidic and eroded due mostly to high precipitation on the forest floor, does it produce certain types of medicinal plants? Like, I'm just thinking it would maybe create some kind of a bitter plant that would be good for certain things, or is it just super hugely varied?
It's hugely varied, and we do find different forest types on different soil types. But, you know, there are rich soils in the Amazon. They're called terra preta, black earth.
Yes,
and
a biochar.
And we now know that that was created by the indigenous peoples themselves. And these soils are so fertile, in some cases, they don't even need fertilizers to grow stuff year-round. So, again, it's just one of those mysteries we're starting to unlock. But we just don't have the information to be able to say, okay, this kind of medicinal plant is going to be found on this soil for this reason.
I see. Well, the river, obviously, is a huge part of this whole scenario. And can you describe the river? Maybe there's a poet in you or someone you've known or read about the Amazon River. And I'm also wondering about the content or the makeup of the water. Is it super mineral rich to be home to so many big, huge and unique fish and creatures?
The best description, simplest description that I committed to memory is written by Richard Spruce, who was a great botanist, ethnobotanist in the 19th century. And he said, very simply, the greatest river runs through the greatest forest in the world. And that sort of minimalist approach, I think, is better than trying to get your arms around something which is so spectacular. You know, fish diversity in the Amazon is greater than the next several non-South American rivers combined. We're always finding new and spectacular examples of how big and rich and diverse it is. And, you know, the studies have just sort of just begun compared to what's out there to be learned. New species being found all the time. I gave the example of the two new species of electric eels, and those are big, conspicuous, dangerous creatures.
Yes.
So it's very hard to do it justice in terms of summing it up in a nice quote and saying, this is the Amazon or this is the Amazon River.
Yeah.
This book was essentially an attempt to kind of do that in a way.
Right. Well, you do a lovely job with it. And it was kind of daunting to start writing questions because everyone seemed like this is so much bigger than that. And I loved reading about the Dominican friar Gaspar de Carvajal. Is that how you pronounce it?
Carvajal.
Yes. And it just threw me into this kind of ethereal dream, imagining him floating down that river in 1541. And of course, my daydream had no bugs, and Marconi's The Mission, I think, was the soundtrack. But wow, just wow, I guess.
Well, you don't have to just imagine it. You can see it. Look at Werner Herzog's classic movie, Aguirre, The Wrath of God, which is about this particularly evil conquistador. But to enrich the story, combine it with Orellana's voyage, of which Carvajal was the friar and the chronicler. So Carvajal's in the film, and you see them floating down that river, and you see Herzog's incredibly fervent imagination of what that must have looked and felt like. So I can't recommend it highly enough. And it's a cult classic. I mean, people that know the Amazon and people that love Herzog and his weirdo movies know this well, but if you're interested in what that voyage is like, it's never going to be depicted better on screen.
Yes, yes, I agree. He's a fantastic filmmaker. Well, Mark, you do come from a long lineage of ethnobotanists that have explored the Amazon. What's the most hair-raising story either you or your predecessors that you've heard about have experienced?
Well, I have to be frank here and admit the one time where I was really scared for my life and felt incredibly threatened was when I was a grad student in New Haven, Connecticut. Crime was out of control. Guns were everywhere. The drug trade, the crack trade was booming. I'd never felt that much of a threat in Amazonia. I mean, I'm not stupid, but I'm not, I don't live in a bubble. So, you know, these stories about jaguars ripping my flesh, they tend to be a bit more exaggerated. I mean, all of us have adventures in our everyday life. You know, you can hike through the Congo and come home and get run over. Margaret Right. Mead, a famous artist, traveled all over the Amazon, this old British lady traveling by herself, and came home to London and got run over by a taxi cab. So, you know, danger is where you find it. Nobody who works in the Amazon in a serious way is looking for it.
No, absolutely not. And I loved reading in the early 1800s, you were talking about when studying to mm-hmm. be a physician, it was not unusual to be a botanist. And certainly this is something of the shamanic tradition. And was that only in Germany, or was that at that time around the world?
No, that was everywhere. I mean, the history of medicine is deeply intertwined with the history of botany and ethnobotany, because the first medicines, by and large, were plants.
Of course.
And we've gotten away from that, which makes sense in a certain way, but I think we're paying the price for, well, many things, for our over-reliance on synthetics, for our divorce from Mother Nature. And I've never felt that, you know, the answer was we just had to go back and live in the woods and that Mother Nature can cure anything. That's way too simplistic. Certainly the pharmaceutical companies have turned their back on natural products for a long time, and that's resulted in the explosion of the herbal market, which is basically good news. So to me, the medical office of the future in some ways will harken back to that past, and that you'll have a physician and you'll have an herbalist and you'll have a massage therapist and you'll have kind of a shaman and you'll have a nutrition therapist, because healing is not just about medicine in the narrow sense.
Yes.
And when you look at the, I'm assuming it's in the billions at this point, value of herbal medicine, you see that people know these things, you see that people want these things, you see that people use these things, and we all recognize that sometimes these herbal medicines are effective. Not always. Same with Western medicine, same with Ayurvedic medicine, same with any medicine. No system has all the answers. I've seen shamans cure things that Western physicians could not, and vice versa.
Absolutely. Mark, why do you think there are so many languages when the region doesn't really have big topographical barriers happening?
You know, Robin, it's a good question, which is unanswered. I'm just guessing that when people went up different rivers, they were kind of separated, because this is where people tend to colonize. They go up the river. It's the most accessible. It's the richest hunting and fishing grounds. And they were sort of self-isolating, big term these days, right? And then when they came back in contact, their languages had changed. So that's just a theory. It's not proven. But again, I haven't heard a better theory. And, you know, cultures and species can evolve in a lot quicker timelines than we often suspect.
Yes. Well, linguistically speaking, can you share something about one of the languages perhaps that seems unique or that stands out as something that is different than other languages?
Well, my all-time favorite is a language called Sunanantomo, which is the lingua franca of the Northeast Amazon, especially centered on Suriname. And it's a mixture of Amerindian, Dutch, Portuguese, a little bit of English, and some Yiddish. And it just shows how people will cobble together the means to be able to communicate. So I can talk to any indigenous person from any tribe, even if I've never seen that tribe, if they speak this. This is why these pidgins, these creoles, crop up, to allow people to communicate. And if left alone, in a sense, it would evolve into a very sophisticated language of its own over time, I imagine. I'm not a linguist.
So, Mark, tell us about the many millions of acres that the over 55 tribes you and the Amazon conservation team have mapped and are protecting. And I would imagine that the protection piece would be ongoing, is it?
Totally ongoing. We started with one sub-tribe in one little village in one little forgotten country, that of Suriname. And once we taught them how to map, but they had to make the map. The next tribe over wanted to do the same thing. So we had the indigenous map makers go over there and train them. And we've now done that for 55 tribes. And again, the point here is not to tell people what to do, which Americans kind of like to do, but anybody who's worked overseas, anybody who has kids, knows that it's kind of human nature. Nobody likes to be told what to do. So instead of saying, this is how you do it, or saying, we're going to do it for you, we work with them to train them to do it themselves. And we're exceedingly proud of that approach, but for several reasons. One, it's truly empowering to have people, some of whom were born in the Stone Age, learn how to use technology on their own terms. Secondly, technology has been oversold as a panacea. Technology can be very destructive. When you go into a village and give everybody a cell phone or an iPad, they all of a sudden think, okay, the outside world has all this magic, and we know and our elders know nothing. But when you introduce it in a way which allows them to document grandma's and grandpa's old stories, when you do it in a way which requires them to go back to grandma and grandpa and find out what's the name of this waterfall, why do we call this mountain by this name, that again is a way to introduce technology in a culturally sensitive way.
Yes, but obviously once we do introduce something, there is no telling where the human is going to take it, and we just have to take it all in. And
yes, but if we don't introduce it in a positive way, it will be introduced in a negative way because it's inevitable. And so, you know, how are you going to introduce contact with the outside world in a bigger way, not just technology? Are you going to tell these people that everything we know is right, everything they know is wrong, everything we wear is correct, everything they wear is wrong? Everything we worship is right, everything they worship is wrong, because frankly, it's kind of been a historical record.
Right. And I have to say, I had a shift in my own thinking years ago when I read The Tales of the Shaman's Apprentice that you wrote, which is certainly a great read still today. And I was reading about the missionaries there and how they helped the indigenous people. And like if the army or the military was coming through, they could perhaps help them hide or get around what was going on. And before that, I did hold the mindset that they were just going down there and trying to make them believe in Jesus or something, which, you know, is a little pushy.
Well, you have a good memory, Robin. But that's true. But we see two basic groups of missionaries in the Amazon. I imagine holds true elsewhere. And one of the educated, I just want to help these people deal with the outside world types, which tend to be Franciscans and more common than not European Franciscans. On the other hand, or types which are fundamentalists, essentially, whose idea is Jesus is going to save these people and they're going to hell unless they accept Jesus ASAP. And it's my way or the highway. So you have that bifurcation. And I had contact early on with these German Franciscans in Brazil. And I could see that, look, they wanted them to accept Jesus, but they weren't going to shove it down their throats. So that, yes, missionaries, all missionaries can provide a positive assistance in terms of Western medicine for introduced diseases. But I don't want to get too far the other way and say, yes, all missionaries are good. Any more than in the past, I wanted to say all missionaries are bad. You know, it's the human condition. There's two sides.
Yes, and it's the same. You mentioned Ford went down there, and I'm sorry, but I had to crack up thinking of a Fordlandia down in the Amazon, you know.
Yeah.
And that, of course, had to do with the whole rubber industry and just with everything that's going on with corporations. Quote from your book, if the driving force behind all decisions that affect the great rainforest are merely maximizing short-term economic return to global elites, the Amazon is doomed. And of course, we are the Amazon. There's no separation, especially in this world today.
Well, you're absolutely right. And it ain't just the Amazon when this type of short-term get-rich-quick planning has screwed up a lot of things, and not just the Amazon, much of the planet. And we don't live in a world where it's possible to go back to some sort of communal existence in the forest or the rainforest, if that ever existed, outside of a few patches. But by the same token, we're all seeing the downsides of overpopulation. We're all seeing the downsides of the wildlife trade. And clearly, we need to do a better job of stewarding the planet right here at home in the Amazon and elsewhere rather than trying to monetize everything all the time, because you can't eat money.
Yes. And
or breathe it or drink it.
Yeah. I'm sure we can find out so much more by going to your website, the Amazon Conservation Team. Is it .org?
We have two websites.
Okay.
One is AmazonTeam.org. That's for the Amazon Conservation Team. And we put up MarkPlotkin.com, where I put a lot of stuff that I don't put on the ACT website, stuff like papers I write on the ethnobotany of warfare, or short talks I've given on why ethnobotanists don't read science fiction. So there's a lot of overlap there. But
wonderful.
You know, to get the full story, you need to check out both of them.
Yes.
The bottom line is that in the world we live in, with all this assault on our senses, you can't just write a book about something. You can't just do a website about something. You can't just do an IMAX film on something. You can't just do an Instagram post on something and think you're going to reach a ginormous audience. So at the same time we're trying to save the forest, at the same time we're trying to partner with cultures to save themselves and the forest, we have the added task of trying to communicate our message to the world at large. And that's why I'm so glad that you, Robin, are giving me this opportunity. I still remember our interview from my Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice Media Tour. That's over 20 years ago.
Oh, my
gosh. So when you find people who can help you amplify the message and reaching the audience that we really need to reach, which is people that really know and care about this stuff but want to learn more, it's key. Because as a small organization, in a world awash in media just slanging stuff to you all day long on every device you have, it's hard to make your voice heard.
Yes, and that's actually one reason, as an aside, I've been doing Tributaries as a weekly for many years now, as you know, but I just started another podcast called Cultivated Audio, and it's all about regenerative agriculture. And same thing, I thought, let's stick to one subject here.
Can you tell us the address for people who want more information on that?
Yes, it's cultivatedaudio.com.
Okay, great. What it sounds like, Robin, is we both sit on both sides of the desk. We have messages to get out. We're trying to amplify other people's voices. And then we have to wonder how to connect with our audience. Because there was a great cartoon in The New Yorker a few months back where this guy was saying, yeah, everybody's podcasting, but nobody's pod listening.
Yes. So
on Walter Cronkite, everybody in America saw it.
Mark, I just want to thank you so much for sharing your spark of wonder and love toward the Amazon and to all in our world. Thank you so much.
Well, Robin, it's a pleasure, even if it's been 20 years, to be back on the program and to reconnect with you and with your listeners, because we're all in this together.
Absolutely. Mark Plotkin, his book, The Amazon, What Everyone Needs to Know. And if you read this book, I guarantee you will know a lot. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasts are on iTunes as Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.